Up next, one of the most fantastic stories I've ever heard, Fire in the Sky, Travis Walton back on Coast to Coast, and we'll talk with him in a moment when we come right back. On a day in November in 1975, a group of loggers in the mountains of northeastern Arizona observed a very strange, unusually bright light in the sky. One of those men, Travis Walton. He left the safety of his truck to take a closer look. When Travis failed to reappear, the men suspected something happened to him.
Maybe he was murdered.
For days, authorities mounted, a massive manhunt in search of Travis Walton. Eventually, he reappeared, very disoriented. Here's Travis Walton on Coast to Coast. Travis, welcome back.
Thanks, George. Good to be back.
They're getting my voice. They're taking it away.
It happens.
What's new with you?
Well, in some ways, it was like yesterday. You know, it's such a life-changing event. It's something that just never leaves you.
You have updated Fire in the Sky. It is still one of the greatest stories I think I've seen in this field. Let's go back a little bit. Let's go back to 1975 when this occurred to you. Yeah, how many of your friends were with you too at the time?
Well, there were seven of us all together, and we were just coming home from a day's work. It was starting to get dark when we saw this object hovering near the road. And I just impulsively got out and went up to get a closer look. Steve and Alan insist that it looks to them like I was under some kind of control, like I was in a trance, but I was really just transfixed by the awe and grandeur of what I was seeing.
Yeah, you were curious about it. So you went, you know, you jumped off the truck, you went looking out there. The movie depicts you standing in the middle of almost like a flat area and the beam hits you. Is that what happened?
Yeah, you know, that was pretty close, except for, you know, in the movie, like this light comes on and just kind of picks the actor up and throws him back. But it was much more violent than that. Steve's insisting now that, you know, that it threw me 20 feet, not 10 feet. But they were convinced that it killed me because the way my body landed without, you know, protecting myself from the fall. And so they just knew they were next, you know.
And they left you there.
Yeah, they were afraid that... you know, it was going to kill them. So, you know, anybody fault with them for, you know, fleeing, you know, have to understand that, you know, why should they risk their lives to save somebody they think's already dead?
Yeah. Did you ever get upset with them, Travis, because they left you?
No, I didn't. But my family came down on them. And so, you know, there was a little bit of friction between me and Mike and maybe some of the other guys that, you know, that I was blaming them. But I never did. And I have to say that they displayed a lot of courage in coming back right after that to try to rescue me.
The story while you were gone was, you know, they're saying this is what happened to you. They don't know where you are. The police department in law enforcement, they didn't believe them, did they?
No, and all throughout the search, you know, the lawmen separated the men out, and each guy had an officer with him that just pushed them throughout the 4 or 5 days of the search. Come on, tell us what really happened. You know, there was maybe it was an accident. Just fess up. You killed him, and you know, we can all go home.
That's right. Which one of you killed him? Just tell us, and you know, let's get this done. But nobody correct. And then weren't there a couple polygraph tests there too, Travis?
Yeah, the sheriff brought in the state police polygraph examiner and tested the men. And when they passed, it was moving on to other ways to try to explain it away. And so that's been kind of my battle all these years to try to, you know, document and refute all these charges and attempts to explain it away. And I think I've done so, and according to a lot of observers, pretty thoroughly.
I think you have too. Absolutely. At this point in your life, I mean, here we are a number of years later since this episode. It's a focal point for your life. You know, we've met before. You've been on the show a number of times. Are you glad it happened to you, or do you wish it never did?
Well, I still have to say I wish it never did. You know, in order to cope with anything, you have to try to find the good in it if you can. And I've done that to a certain extent, but still, you know, I'd rather it never happened.
Any nightmares associated with this anymore?
Oh, they were really intense right afterwards, but not so much anymore. people who hear me sleeping, you know, hear me fighting in my sleep, but when I wake up, I don't remember the dreams anymore. So, you know, it could have been anything. So I really don't know if I'm having those kind of traumatic nightmares anymore.
Are you still remembered now as the person who was abducted?
Yeah, it's come to define me, regrettably, but that's just...
It is what it is.
Yeah, that's what life hands me, so I have to, you know, go with what happened.
Kim Carlsberg was telling us that she thinks there's indeed a alien hybrid program going on. She thinks that they're going to intermix them with us. I'm not so sure, but the program, nonetheless, is something's happening. What's your take on all of this, Travis?
Well, you know, I think that my particular experience was a little different. I've gone along with the term abduction, but, you know, in more recent years, I've you know, kind of analyzed this and thinking that maybe it wasn't really all that intended to start with, that the beam hitting me was some kind of an accident, and that it had, you know, possibly killed me, or at least, you know, put me into cardiac arrest. And so what they were actually doing was trying to rescue me. In other words, rather than abduction, I'd say more of an ambulance call.
That's interesting. Why do you think they came here?
Who knows, you know, yeah. And why there? Some people say, oh, they had to be laying for you, you know, that they targeted you and they were after you. But I don't know, you know, it could have been they were having car trouble or something.
And there they were. Hey, ironically, I'm in Albuquerque tomorrow. You're signing the new edition of Fire in the Sky on Saturday, are you not?
Yeah, on the 10th at Page One Books. That's
super.
Kind of a coincidence you're going there.
We're being drawn by a force, Travis. You never know.
Yeah.
The guys that were with you then, everybody scattered now? Is everybody all over the country, or where are they?
Well, yeah, you know, and for years, Steve, the youngest guy on the crew, didn't want to talk about it, and he just stayed out of sight. But he popped up here a couple of years ago, and I'm going to be speaking with him in Huntington Beach here pretty quick on the 29th, I think it is. So it'll be his first outing after all this time, and that's kind of interesting to, you know, to reconnect with him. I was on the Today Show with John Gillette, another crew member,
sure, here, yeah,
in February. And it's, you know, not having talked to him all these years, it's kind of interesting to hear a lot about, you know, their take on it, because they were there during, obviously, time that I wasn't. And so
what has happened to their lives since this episode? I mean, we know how this has affected you over the years. How about them? I mean, were they able to, you know, mix back into society and carry on, or did they have problems because of this?
Oh, I'm sure there was a few, especially if, you know, until they left the area. But I think in many respects it was easier for them to blend in. John's story of being there and having this guy describe how his claim that he was there and he was on the crew and everything. And of course, John was actually on the crew, and he knows this isn't true, but he never said anything and just let the story go.
Travis, what about scientists or anybody, military, anybody trying to find out exactly what happened to you?
Well, there has been some follow-up research with the phenomenal growth of the trees nearest where the craft descended. But as far as the official government, you know, there's been some harassment. And I heard from Mike recently that they're still at it with him for some reason. People who actually identify themselves with federal identification and stuff.
And what do you mean by that? There's something new with the trees? What does that mean?
Well, where the craft came down, the trees nearest there exhibited a phenomenal increase in growth. And with the tree ring samples that were taken, you can count back the number of rings from the time of the incident and see that the growth suddenly spurted to where they were producing 36 times the quantity of wood fiber that they had in the preceding 85 years.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
And just in a certain area.
Yeah, just right in a circle around where the craft came down, and it dissipates in the surrounding area.
Fire in the Sky, the new edition, and of course it was a good read then, and I'm sure it's a great one today, Travis. When you look at the movie Fire in the Sky, what do you think of that?
Well, you know, I think it was a good thing in many ways that it really helped to open people's minds. It was one of the first times, well, the first time that a real-life incident was turned into a theatrical movie. But I've gotten a tremendous number of emails over the years from people who wish they had stuck closer to the real story. So I'm looking to get a remake of the movie.
Oh, really? That'd be great.
Yeah, you know, anybody who would email me, you know, I'm going to bring all these emails that I've been getting to the studio and see if we can convince them to retell it.
If I recall, a couple of years ago, you told me on the show that the scene in the movie where you woke up in these honeycombs didn't happen like that, if I remember.
No, it didn't.
Yeah.
No, it didn't. There's a few things that I would say were allegorical or symbolic to a certain degree and in communicating things that I felt and experienced. But generally, you know, the whole look of the interior being cluttered and organic rather than sterile and mechanical is just, you know, kind of the opposite of what was happening there.
Do you recollect the extraterrestrials that were involved in this abduction?
Yeah, it was, you know, absolutely the most traumatic part of the whole incident, of course, was looking into the eyes of these creatures. It was just...
It's got to be something.
Unbearable.
Yeah. I mean, at one point, if you believe in extraterrestrial life, it's got to be somewhat exciting, but at the same time, it's got to be unnerving to see that. And you know, because then it hits you that it's real.
Yeah. And for a long time, I thought it was just the fact that these eyes were so huge and they were staring. But more and more, I'm thinking, well, you know, the whole reason I was able to get off the table and you know, they were approaching me and that stare and the way it affected me, I'm thinking that perhaps the beam hitting me in the upper body like that caused some sort of neurological disruption that prevented them from controlling me. And that stare was them trying to reassert control.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what, you know, was so disturbing. That's why that fed into my nightmare.
At any point, did you feel that you could be harmed by them?
Oh, I felt very threatened. But
oh, you did. All right.
In retrospect, you know, they may have just been trying to, you know, get me back on the table and finish the procedure, whatever, you know.
They're probably saying, come on, let's get with it, Travis. Get this over with. You were gone how long?
5 days and 6 hours.
Okay. When you showed up again, where were you?
I found myself on the road outside of the town nearest where it happened, which is not the town where I live. The town where I live is a wide valley where, had they descended anywhere near here, they would have been in view of hundreds of people, whereas Heber is kind of hidden down in some steep canyons, and it's real easy once they descend to not be visible to anyone.
Were you in shock?
I was definitely, you know, traumatized to a very high extent. I couldn't even tell my family, you know, everything that had happened. Every time I'd start to talk about it, I'd just break down. It was so very traumatic.
Did they feed you on the craft? Do you remember that?
You would think they would have to. The medical tests didn't reveal any evidence of starvation.
Or dehydration or anything
well,
like that.
There was some dehydration, but, you know, the speed with which my weight returned, you know, suggested to the doctor that it was mostly dehydration.
When you showed up, what did law enforcement say to you?
Well, they, you know, of course, were pursuing all kinds of...
I mean, they thought you were dead, right?
Yeah, uh-huh. Well, they were upset that they weren't immediately informed of my return, but, you know, the family had got a lot of very ominous calls, warnings from, you know, a former CIA guy who said, watch out, who gets a hold of him if he ever returned, and this one lady said she was a nurse in a hospital where a couple was brought in after such an incident, and they disappeared, their records disappeared, and everybody was, you know, pretending that they hadn't been there, so... And then some UFO investigators made some similar warnings. So all that led the family to not want to turn immediately to the sheriff when I was returned. They took me to the doctor instead.
Who picked you up? Your family?
Yeah, my brother-in-law and brother came and got me.
What'd you do, stumble to a phone booth, or what happened?
Yeah. You didn't have to have a coin to talk to the operator at the in this part of the country.
Okay.
So, you know, I was able to make a call to my brother-in-law. He was the only nearby relative.
He must have been in shock when he talked to him.
Well, he didn't believe it was me. He thought it was more prank calls. The family had been getting all kinds of calls, and he'd started to hang up on me. But I managed to convince him it was me, and so they came and got me.
Did it not even sound like you?
Well, no, it didn't. I'm sure I was pretty freaked out. It was only, you know, with some screaming at him that it was me that,
yeah,
that I was able to convince him it was me.
Were you clothed, or did they just drop you off with nothing?
Yeah, that was Hollywood. I was not. There was nothing. That was Hollywood.
That was Hollywood. Okay.
Obligatory nude scene, but no, I was dressed and in the same clothes that I was taken in.
After all this has happened, Travis, have there ever been any reconnections with them?
Well, you know, if I was to see something similar again, I don't know that I'd come forward. You know, I'm complimented for being someone who was willing to come forward, but I didn't really come forward. You know, it was worldwide news by the time I was returned.
Yeah, you didn't have a choice.
Yeah, the media came to me, so I was mainly just defending myself against a whole lot of crazy theories.
But, I mean, so many people who have been taken report that they get taken again and then again. How about you?
Well, I don't know. You know, heck, even if I was to recover more memories, I'm not sure I'd want to even talk about it. You know?
Are you telling me something by not telling me something?
I don't know. I've had some dreams that maybe glimpses of something, but... Yeah.
Because my take is that, you know, they picked you up for a reason, and these aren't normally one-time things, and I would assume that it probably has happened a couple more times.
Well, there was this thing when I was a kid. All my brothers and sisters teased me about it. A little bald-headed man dragging me down the hallway. It was just such a vivid dream. I spent the day looking for where he went, you know. But, you know, I thought, and that it was just a dream. And maybe.
And this little ball-headed man could have been a little E.T.
Well, that's possible, but, you know, could have been a dream, too.
Travis' website's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And, again, he's got a book signing. It's called the Page One Bookstore. It's in Albuquerque, New Mexico. It's going to be this Saturday from 10 o'clock to 1 p.m., 10 in the morning to 1 p.m., with his new edition, Fire in the Sky. And I don't know if any of you have not read his first book, Fire in the Sky, which this is the new edition version of, you're really missing something. It's better than the movie, honestly, and it's an incredible story. I remember, Travis, this entire story, and I was mesmerized by it when it happened. I mean, you were taken. I was 25 years old when you were gone. And it was at what point did it hit the major media after that episode? Well, did it happen right away when you came back, or was it?
Yeah, there were crews here from Japan and England before I was ever returned. So it was a madhouse.
Yeah, it was a major story. You didn't get as much public. It started getting publicity, I think, when they started saying something happened to you, got hit by this beam of light.
Yeah.
I think if it was just a disappearance or a missing person, it probably wouldn't have been that widespread until after the fact when the story was here. But when you first told the story to law enforcement, I mean, did they believe you?
Well, the sheriff tried to keep a lid on it with the searchers, to asking them to not, you know, go to the media, but that didn't last long. But no, I think that, you know, from the beginning, you know, law enforcement, that's just where they are. It started off with a murder and went from there, you know.
All right, Travis, good luck to you on your book signing. I'm George Norrie. I'll be back with more in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And our next special guest, Robert Miles, author, screenwriter, has worked as a producer and executive producer for the past 45 years, producing and writing a DVD series called Fast Walkers Open Files. Now, it's a series that features numerous interviews with the most highly respected UFO and extraterrestrial researchers, abductees, and contactees all over the world. Here's Robert Miles on Coast to Coast. Robert, good to have you with us. How are you?
Oh, thank you, George. Good morning to you and all your listening audience out there on Coast to Coast. Great show.
Fast Walkers. How did you, a screenwriter, a producer, how'd you get interested in this?
Well, George, it goes way back to 40 years ago when I had my encounter. And although people didn't know it, when I interviewed them for Fast Walkers, I had the most incredible encounter. You know, it's just unbelievable, and it's totally changed my life from that point on.
Tell us what happened to you, Robert.
Well, you know, most of your guests talk about being abducted, but I wasn't abducted. I went willingly. I was on my ship. I had built a 47-foot trimaran.
Okay.
And sailed it to Hawaii, and I was there living on the boat in Alawai Yacht Harbor. And I'm sure you've been there in Oahu, there in Honolulu, and you know there's 300 boats there.
I've been there, and it's a gorgeous area. As a matter of fact, we just built a studio for me on the Big Island near Kona.
Oh, you lucky guy.
I can't wait. I haven't fired it up yet, but I'm going to.
Well, boy, I'll tell you, that's a great place. I sailed around all the islands there for 2 years and ended up because, you know, when you have a boat, you got to keep it up. And I was working, I was painting and building on a big skyscraper there on Waikiki.
Okay.
And I was in my boat, and we had decided to sell the boat. And we had sold it to the first person to walk down the dock, and in the morning we were going to deliver it. I always got up early, and I was up early and got dressed and went in and put on a pot of coffee. And the next thing I knew, I went back to my bunk, and I was sitting on my big double bunk looking up at through the skylight at the beautiful breaking morning. And all of a sudden, there was this incredible energy that seemed to be within the room, and the next thing I knew, I mean, I was getting a psychedelic kind of light show, and this beautiful woman materialized in my stateroom, right on the walkway there in my stateroom, and honest to God, I thought I was hallucinating or dreaming. I mean, I couldn't believe it, and the energy. Anyone who's ever stuck their finger in a 110 light socket knows what that's like. But George, this was like 440, only it wasn't painful. It was almost orgasmic, but not in a sexual way.
Right.
It just, you know, it was just incredible. And I, she said, "Hello, Robert." And I said, "This can't be happening. I must be dreaming." And she said, "No, you're not dreaming." And I said, "Well, then, what's going on? Why are you here?" And she said, "We're your friends, and I've come here to ask you if you'd like to come with me." And you know, I didn't even hesitate. She said, "What I want you to do is I want you to close your eyes and decide you're there." And I said, "I can't do that. I mean, I just can't do that." And she said, "Yes, you can. We can help you." And the next thing I knew, I was teleported, and this part of the story is totally weird. And most people, until the time of quantum physics and the multiverse, mm-hmm. that would say I was totally psychotic or delusional. But, you know, I was there. I was in LaGuardia Airport. There were other people around me. She had told me to go up and get a ticket on the Jupiter flight. you know, now other people say, well, you know, was it another dimension? And my answer to that, you know, and I've researched that for 40 years, I don't know. But I'll tell you this, I had a body.
So you have a body and you go up to the ticket counter and you tell the agent, "I need a ticket to Jupiter?"
Yeah, on the Jupiter flight. And and so I went there, and I asked for the ticket, and they didn't ask for money. They gave me a ticket. She said, "Go right over there and take that elevator and go on up to the concourse." I did that. I went up to the concourse, except it was totally different than any concourse I've ever seen, even since. And it was luxurious. It had beautiful pointed couches.
And you're fully conscious about when all this is going on.
Exactly, George.
That's amazing.
Exactly. And so I was there, and there were other people there, both young and old. And within a few minutes, this lady dressed in this beautiful, and this is before the days of Lycra, okay?
Yeah.
And she had this Lycra-like beautiful blue uniform on with this diagonal V in the front of her uniform, and in multicolors like a rainbow. And she said, "Come on board." And we went in, and I was seated. It was like a circular seating area. There were beautiful padded lounges. There was a porthole right beside me. And down on the console between the two seats where I was sitting were these like digital time clocks, except digital didn't exist then.
Interesting. Days. What if you were in either a multiverse or you were way into the future?
Well, you know, there's a lot of my story that's about the future. And hopefully we can get into that, because you ask about Kim Carlsberg with that great book, The Other Close Encounters, about what people are thinking about the cataclysms.
That's right.
And the Earth changes and the things that are coming down. Well, when I went to Jupiter and I was briefed for what seemed to me a day or more, but was only 33 minutes when I got back. And Brad Steiger earlier in your show said they have the power to manipulate time or to make it appear or something. And that's exactly what happened.
So this had this incredible effect on you over the years. And
right?
I mean, as a screenwriter and producer, did you work in other fields or was it always, you know, UFO driven?
Oh, no. Executive produced and produced a psycho thriller called Ice Cold in Phoenix.
Okay.
I did an old classic thing on RVing called Quartzsite, The American Venture. I've done Sail Away about sailing on ships because I've built 5 seagoing ships. And that brings me to my mission, which you might want to get into. When I went to that briefing, I was briefed that there was a situation going on Earth, and we on the Earth had this choice of whether or not it was going to happen, and either we could change it. You know, we have free will, George, as you well know.
We do.
I loved your book, Lightworker.
Thank you.
I was briefed, and I was asked if I would accept the mission. And I did, and there's been times in my life that I sure wished I didn't, you know, because it has totally changed me.
Tell me about the series Flashwalkers, Fast Walkers.
Well, Fast Walkers was a great undertaking. I was fortunate that I had a co-producer in Germany, Bruce Jessup, and then my son Anthony Miles, who was a television guy and extremely good at editing, and a great guy in Bulgaria, Stoyan Chernovska, and he's an ex-MiG pilot, and he did the graphics and a lot of things. But we went out, we went all over. We went to all the big UFO conventions, Steve Bassett.
Oh, sure.
Bob Brown, all those guys helped us get access to the top people in the world. And then we went ahead and we went to some of the people's homes that weren't there. We did interviews in Germany. We did interviews all over. And pulled together, I guess there were 50-some interviews, and we ended up, I'm not sure exactly how many, but virtually an awful lot of the good guys.
Yeah, you've got, Robert, the creme of the creme, creme de la creme, and let me give out your website, which is, of course, linked up at coasttocoastam.com, but it is fastwalkers.com, and it's an incredible series of stories of some of the top, I mean the top, UFO and extraterrestrial researchers in the country. Okay, here's Miriam Delicato, author of Blue Star, Fulfilling Prophecy, incredible work, an abductee from birth. She was given information on board a craft that has led her to her work of indigenous people assisting human evolution and consciously and environmentally as well. It does a great job. Good to have you back, Miriam. How are you?
I'm very well, George. Nice to be back.
This is our extravaganza night on ETs and extraterrestrials. Do you think your abduction case affected the direction that you've gone in?
Oh, there's absolutely no doubt about that. You know, this is a fascinating part of the work, and I want to point out something that Brad said in the first hour that was so touching to me, because I heard him say that as we've moved through this phenomenon, that we've begun to realize that everything around this, the UFO abductee research, is finding that it's connecting to everything in life.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, having this experience that I did in 1988, where I, you know, physically went on board a craft with these blonde-haired, blue-eyed beings, I mean, I walked back off as if I was another person. And Travis is bringing this up, and Kim is talking about this. I think this is one of the keys to this evolution that we're moving through as far as the planet. And it's getting really pumped up because of the number of sightings that are happening, and also because the number of people that are stepping forward that are truly credible witnesses to these extraordinary events, and having family members come forward. It's not just one person standing alone anymore. It's like a whole family will come forward, and friends around that person. And I think that we're finally moving to a point where these kind of discussions can and have the potential to move forward in a way that's really going to find answers at this point, George.
Well, I think so, too. And I think, if anything, what tonight's exercise proves, just with cases of you, Miriam, and Robert, and Kim, and everyone else, it's just in Travis Walton, just the amazing amount of people who have been affected by this situation. I mean, it must be in the millions. It's got to be.
Well, I think that it is at this point. You know, there was a time when that question, I think even when I've been on with you in the past, and I said, you know, thousands, you know, if not at least thousands and thousands of people. But at this point, after seeing how this has sort of burst in the last few years, I wouldn't be surprised if it's millions of people. And of course, you know, other things are coming forward where new information and puzzle pieces, you know, you always hear us saying these things, these puzzle pieces, and we all have them, all of us that have had these kind of experiences. But the thing is that on a global scale, these puzzle pieces are starting to fit together a little bit more clearly now. And although there's all of these conspiracy theories and theories about good and bad and evil and what's actually happening, I think we're getting closer to be able to understand and comprehend what it is that's going on.
Well, what's interesting, too, is we're beginning to get real news stories from real, you know, credible agencies, NASA, JPL, people like that, universities. I mean, the one I just had at our first hour of the program, Miriam, where they said specifically that whatever's going on in this planet, whether it's man-made or otherwise, it's enough to make an alien civilization say something's happening over there. We need to go fix it before they destroy themselves. Whoever would have thought that a few years ago a university or some spokesperson from NASA would even use that as an example?
Well, exactly. And this is the whole point, you see. I often bring this up as an analogy to assist people in understanding how far we've come. In 1988, when I walked off that craft, within 2 days, I started talking about aliens and UFOs. And everyone looked at me and they would literally say to me, George, now maybe different in your world, but in my world and in my reality that I lived in at the time, people would actually say to me, what is an extraterrestrial? Because they didn't even know the terminology. And so that's how far we've come since 1988 in the whole genre of the whole planet. So we're shifting our consciousness, and that does, I believe, and always have, that has had a direct result of these beings, just like Kim talked about, where there's literally hundreds or hundreds of people laying on these beds, I guess she was talking about.
Yeah. What's new and update us on Blue Star Fulfilling Prophecy?
Well, there's quite a bit that's happening in that regard. I mean, I've been involved with some really exciting work as of late with the Hopi, where we actually were able to meet with the Dalai Lama. And I was present at that. And, you know, I think that I just wanted to share that, because to say that even though I'm a UFO alien contactee, these ancient cultures have had these enormous stories that they've been holding to for thousands of years, and they're slowly being released. And now the Dogon, I'm also working with members of the Dogon tribe, who, of course, are also very much connected to the Sirius star system.
Great story there.
So this story for myself and the work that I've been doing has been really moving forward at light speed. And what I want to get across to you, George, what I want to really get across to the listeners is this, is that so many years ago when I first initiated this contact, like when they did, and put me on that craft, I couldn't even have imagined where I would be today in my personal journey. But what's relevant to the rest of the world is that all of these crazy pieces that they talked to me about all those years ago are being absolutely verified every step of the way.
They're all falling in place, aren't they?
They are. And so the Blue Star Prophecy, I'm still hoping that the Hopi will come forward and make statements about that. And you got to know that that's one thing that this girl is working on for everyone, because I believe that it's time that we know what that prophecy actually means, because so many people are talking about
it. How much of it echoes the December 21st, 2012 Mayan date?
It doesn't, and that's what I know for sure from these religious leaders, is that it's not in complete, it's not completely mirrored by what it is that's coming out in the media and through the books and through the people. It's about the interpretation, and we have to be very careful with the interpretation. So I know that these Hopi religious leaders, the interpretation is not exactly mirroring the Mayans, but it is similar. There are similarities.
Oh, there sure are.
Yes.
I'm fascinated by that, too.
Well, we're going to be seeing each other, I think, in a couple of weeks out there in Los Angeles at another event.
Okay.
And we'll be able to talk a lot about that then, George. So thank you.
I mean, so much is happening these days. It is amazing that people can even keep track of what's going on. But, you know, we seem to be doing it. I'm amazed, Marion, at how so many networks in different venues are interested in this. I mean, I think the History Channel, for example, I think they're doing a great job on the Ancient Alien series.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
You know, we're in the year three on this already. And
well, whenever I hear of a show like that, whenever I hear intelligent conversation that's not so off the mark, that it's not even relevant to what it is that we need to look at first before we can go into some of these even more esoteric thoughts and thinking. And what's great is that these things are coming out into mainstream, as we've both said, and that the History Channel is doing a great job. I think that they are. And I'm looking forward to the day when even more, and for people like myself, that we will be heard even more. Because there's a lot of these pieces that get repeated by us, and they get glazed over and glazed over. And then finally, it's like something happens and people go, click. Oh, that's right. This is what's happening. And that's apparent to me when people talk about what Brad just did, saying that everything's connected.
Well, you did a great job with Blue Star Fulfilling Prophecy. Thank you, Miriam. And I'll be back in a moment with your phone calls with Kim Carlsberg as we talk about the art of close encounters.